Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Greg Eisenberg. Greg is the CEO of Late Checkout, a holding company for community-based internet businesses. Greg has founded three venture-backed startups and has been an advisor to TikTok and Reddit. Greg, welcome to World of DAS.
Hello, fellow data nerds, and hello, Oren.
Really excited. Now, you've got this great long-form tweet on the future building startups. What do you think the biggest differences in the new startup model are?
Ooh, how much time do you have? I wrote that tweet. There's certain things that really resonated with people. So I said, the future of building startups, MVP speed, one per month. I think that really resonated, the fact that when I say MVP, I mean minimal viable product. We're coming from a place where it used to take a year, 18 months, 24 months to create a really, and I don't love actually the term MVP, more of like a minimal lovable product. But now you can create a minimal lovable product in 30 days. And the reason you can do that is because you're standing on the shoulder of giants.
And there's like all these low code and other types of things to spin things up really quickly.
Exactly. And then I think now with a lot of the co-pilot stuff happening, agent stuff happening in AI, it makes it even quicker. So for me, that's like the biggest thing, the biggest tangible thing that has changed over the last 5 years is the fact that building something is cheaper than ever, faster than ever.
Then you don't really need VC funding for most of these. I mean, as long as you can like pay your own rent and buy some tuna fish or whatever you're consuming, you don't really need that much more to start these companies.
I've done the venture thing a few times. My last company was acquired by WeWork, and WeWork is like the poster child of when venture capital goes wrong. But there are examples of how venture capital could go right. There's a lot of companies that wouldn't exist today without the help of venture capital. That being said, I think for the vast majority of entrepreneurs and probably people listening to this, it's good to set up your business so that venture capital is optional, not required. And I think we're moving into that world right now.
Sam Lesson has this idea that every round you get in your head should be like the last round. How do you think about that?
Realistically, venture investors don't invest, so it's the last round. Because the way the venture business works is you invest at the seed level at a $10 million valuation. Your incentive then becomes for that founder to raise at a $40 million valuation, Series A.
So you can mark it up to your portfolio.
Exactly. So that they can raise more funds, get more fees. Show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcomes. And I actually really like what Slow is doing with Sam Lesson's fund. I think they're doing a lot of interesting new models. Like, for example, they have this really cool creator fund. Well, they'll go and invest in a top creator and basically say, I want 10% of your earnings for the next 30 years, but I'm going to give you $5 million. They are doing really interesting things. But that being said, I still think that a venture investor wants markups.
So do you think VC, because of this, is going to move into like more tougher, riskier industries? A great example would be like SpaceX or something. Or do you think some of the software stuff, maybe the capital needs are not as high?
When I first got into internet startups and stuff like that, social networking, marketplaces, community software, you really needed venture capital. So I like studied the venture capital game a lot and how to play it and how to raise money and who to go to and all this stuff. But now in the software world, 99% of the time you don't need it. I think that deep tech, medical devices, that sort of thing is where venture capital is going to probably thrive over the next 10 years. I'm looking at what are more risky bets and what are bets that require a lot of capital. And also, I actually saw today Cody Sanchez. I don't know if you know her. She runs a holding company of boring businesses, laundromats and stuff like that. Anyways, I just saw that right before this that she had raised $5 million of venture funding. And one of the reasons she said she raised it was because if you have a lot of people rooting against you, it's very helpful to have billionaire investors backing you. So for example, Uber was going against the taxi industry. And so a lot of taxi drivers were unhappy with Uber. Having billions of dollars of cash to go and fight those lobbies probably helped make Uber, Uber. Industries like that, I still think there's opportunity.
One of the biggest costs for a lot of these tech companies is like sales and marketing. It's not the development costs. How does that cost go down in the new world?
Let's just talk about marketing first. I think there's a lot of really interesting AI products that help make creating marketing faster. Did you see like this Sora demo?
Of course, yeah.
If you can go and create 30-second videos that look Hollywood style in like 2 minutes, your marketing cost just went down. So price of marketing will go down. Now sales, go look at who gets paid the most at any company. It's a salesperson. I don't really anticipate sales seeing the same shift, as dramatic as a shift as marketing, but I do think that the cost of a salesperson goes down because they will have sales agents, prospecting agents, other tools that could help them do their job a lot quicker.
If you don't feel pressure to grow 100% year over year, you can invest very profitably in sales. You can bring on salespeople. You don't have to bring on 50 new salespeople and only 10 of them are going to work out or something. You can bring them on much slower.
That's a great point. We often forget how important compounding is. And you create a 500K business year one, 750K, a million, 1.25, grow like 25% or something year over year, but do it for 15 years. And you end up with a really big business.
For sure. Especially if you own 100% of it.
It's unreal. I mean, I think, and you look at it, and I was just talking to someone, he's been building a few content websites that are driven by SEO. I think he had like 5 websites. He's been doing it for 15 years. Him and 2 other developers, they're based somewhere in Europe. He just sold it for $13 million, cash closed. And it's like changed him and these 2 people's lives and their families. It's unreal.
That's awesome.
I think also you're going to start hearing more of these stories. So that'll also inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs to basically be like, you know what? Maybe I won't raise that round. Maybe I'll be like this guy in Europe.
For a lot of these guys, there's not a lot of reason to like have a hype machine around them because they're not trying to raise more money. Probably most of us will never hear about them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I also think that this particular guy, I was like, dude, get on Twitter, get on post up. And he was like, no. Like I made my money being quiet. I think there's a lot of these people who are just happy to do it quietly. I respect that just as much as someone who wants to be public about things.
A lot of maybe these like solopreneurs right now, but you've also said there's this real play of being a multipreneur. How do you think about that?
My thesis is that multipreneurship is the future of entrepreneurship. What multipreneurship means to me is you're not just building one business, you're building a portfolio of businesses powered by the internet. Some of those businesses you can start yourself, incubate yourself, like this guy in Europe. He just built all these websites. Some of them you can incubate or potentially even acquire. So maybe you have a few that you acquire, a few that you've incubated. I think this idea of being a multipreneur, which is someone who has a holding company essentially that owns a bunch of these internet businesses, is going to be more and more popular because of some of the reasons that we talked about. It's quicker than ever to build something. Distribution now exists in a lot of different channels that are cheap, essentially. Think about social traffic, things like that. You can tap into it. The other thing is there's now billions of people online daily on phones and on desktops and soon to be in virtual reality where you can sell them these things and these people are willing to take out their credit card and pay for things online. 15 years ago, the idea of buying a car on the internet, some people did it, of course, but it wasn't so popular. Now things like that are getting way more popular. Why I'm so interested in the world of multipreneurship is because I think that the stars are just aligning.
Now in internet 1.0, probably the most successful multipreneur holding company would be IAC, Barry Diller. Are there folks that you've studied and learned from past eras that can be like applicable to today's era?
In general, I'm one of those people that I think the best way to invent the future is to look at the past. Last night, right before I went to sleep, I tweeted, this business was ahead of its time. And it was an image of AskJeeves.com. I was kind of joking in that tweet because AskJeeves was basically ChatGPT before ChatGPT. It was AI agents.
And speaking of Barry Diller, they did buy that. So IAC bought that.
Exactly. So I look at IAC as a model, Bill Gross. In some ways, this is in the venture world, but Paul Graham, what he built with Y Combinator was just so great. And also how he had his media component, like Hacker News was the media part of his business that no one talks about. So he was able to attract the smartest engineers in the world to this media property. And then they'd be like, oh, what's Y Combinator? And then I also think about looking not just in internet world, but like media titans. Who are the biggest media titans in the last 100 years? The Rupert Murdochs and Summer Redstones and people like that, where you can look and be like, how did these people create multiple products, multiple businesses, acquisition fueled, and apply that to 2024?
On the venture studio side, it is like a weird business where often they fail for two reasons. One, because they never have a hit. And the second one is because they have too big of a hit. Somebody's like Uber was part of like a venture studio, and then it became like too big of a hit and Travis joined it. One of the studios that seems to be doing extremely well is Flagship Pioneering. Like they did Moderna and they do all these other really successful biotech companies. Is there something about just being super, super focused that could be helpful?
A lot of people say, why are you starting a studio? Most studios fail. First of all, I think most startups fail too. The question is, what are you going to be more successful at? I would say that a studio on average does better than a startup long term. So that's one piece. I think the folks who built Moderna and those people, I don't know exactly what made them successful. But what I can tell you is that here's some things that I've seen. What is the recipe for a studio that's been successful? I think one is you don't need to raise venture capital for your studio, because then you are on that same treadmill that you would be on if you're a startup. That's one thing. Also, like having a very focused thesis is really helpful. The hard part about running a studio is you literally could do anything, but you have to be very, very conscious about the types of things that you incubate or buy, because you want to have it so each individual product feeds off each other. There's shared learnings, maybe shared systems, shared processes. I also think that the studios that do the best have some sort of distribution advantage. We talked about YC having Hacker News. One of the ways, if you're thinking about starting a studio, you might just want to start by building media. And then from there, you can actually build the products.
One studio that I really admire that was built in like the mid-2000s was Lightbank. And they were based in Chicago. And they had this one advantage where they're just really good at selling to SMBs. And they just built 8 or 10 companies, I don't know how many, that just kept selling, just really good companies that would sell to these SMBs. And the only reason why I kind of stopped is they had a few that went public, but then I'm having the mega hit, which is Groupon. I like the fact that they kind of started the same company over and over again.
Our model is, we call it the ACP funnel, audience, community, product. So we start each business with an audience, then we convert some of that internet audience into a community, then we build a product for that community, with that community. So we've basically created this process around how to do it. And it's similar to Lightbank. In no Groupon level successes, but I think the idea is similar in the sense that we focus on the community where they also, I would imagine, focused on a particular subsegment of SMBs. And they're like, we're just going to like focus on this community and then build a bunch of products that service their customer journey. And I think that's really smart.
A startup studio, you could think of as a VC where you make a hit-driven business where you have a power law distribution. Or you can think of it more like a private equity firm or something where there's going to be lots of mid-level winners and stuff. And maybe every once in a while, you're going to get a great hit. How do you think about it?
I think about it not similar to either of those. I think about it as I own real estate. I have different properties. Some may be commercial, some might be residential, some might be turn into a skyscraper. So it might be a one bedroom apartment that I'm renting out at $800 a month. We focus on cash flowing businesses. Margins are important to us. Making profit at the end of the year is really important to us. So I just think about this is like a piece of property ultimately that is generating some level of cash. And I think then we have to be more developers. Okay, this is great on one floor. How do we add a second floor, a third floor, and stuff like that? So that's how we think about it. It allows us to value M&A. It gives us a better, clearer view, more HD view into M&A because we know what a business is worth to us based on this model.
One of the things I find as I get older is that when you're young, the core thing you're trying to figure out is to differentiate good opportunities from bad opportunities. You just see a lot more good opportunities as you get older and have a little bit of success. Your core thing is really trying to figure out great opportunities. And sometimes great opportunities come disguised as bad opportunities. How do you not end up in this trap where you just keep doing good opportunities over and over again?
I think that if we ended up doing good opportunities over and over again, we would still fast forward as long as we're healthy and stuff like that. Fast forward 15, 20 years and it'll work. The model will work. The point I'm trying to make is you actually don't need to build a Groupon to win.
You just keep getting that one bedroom apartment and all of a sudden you become extraordinarily wealthy.
I actually don't think it's more complicated than that.
In your case, part of it is you're often working with a partner, quote unquote, CEO of these companies. How do you think about this person? What should they look like? What do you think is the person who's going to be the most successful?
One of our partners and CEOs that has been performing the best actually comes from Lightbank. Our ultimate goal at Late Checkout is to build a holding company of holding companies. We will incubate a product and then hopefully that works. And then we'll have like an adjacent product that we'll incubate. And then now there'll be two products. And then the GM and CEO of that first product might now be the CEO of the holding companies for those two products. Now he has two CEOs and GMs under him.
It's like multi-layer marketing or something.
Exactly. I always say, sounds like a pyramid scheme, but there's no scheme. Ultimately, it's just a model around instead of running one company, you're running multiple companies. You're essentially empowering these capital allocators slash builders to accelerate and own a bunch of properties. We tend to like operators that understand capital allocation. Lightbank also is like a VC, for example, and at the same time, understand how to build zero to one incubation. So that for us is like our unicorn type of person that we love to work with.
And how do you suss that out when you're meeting people and talking with them?
On the zero to one, it's like, show me things that you've built zero to one. For us, content is really important because a lot of our businesses have internet audiences and communities as a part of it. So we'll say, have you gone viral? And if the answer is no, chances are you're not a great fit for that CEO role. Even once, something that's taken off zero to one. And then capital allocator is just someone who knows how to allocate capital. And they don't need to have bought big companies before, but someone who's in their own way taking capital to make more capital.
That makes sense. Now, these social platforms are at least a part of community building that are out there. How do you think of what are the platforms to build on that we should be investing in today versus what we did 5 years ago?
5 years ago, the world in the social world looked very different. And then 5 years before that, it looked very different. 5 years before that, it looked very different. So it's always changing, which is what is so fun about social. There's always opportunity in social. As we're recording this, TikTok is being talked about being banned, but it is still one of the best places to go viral on the internet today. And people will say, well, oh, it's for young people. Now it's quite ubiquitous. There's such a big audience on TikTok that I think it's a great platform to create on. And it also gets you to become a short form video master. Short form is just the gasoline of the internet right now.
For people who don't understand it, why is that the case?
Why is it? Is because if you run a social platform, or if you're Instagram, if you're Elon Musk at X, you want people to stay on your platform as long as possible. So it's faster to read text than to watch video. So that's one reason. And the second reason is if you're in the business of ads, you're selling ads, Twitter makes more money or Meta makes more money selling video ads than they do a text link or an image. So for those two reasons, the platforms prioritizing the algorithm, short form video.
Are they actually more shareable? Are those the things that the average person likes more?
I think the average person does like video. It's like one of the best storytelling mediums we have out there. You have a mix of, it's rich in terms of it's essentially stitched images together. You have sound, you're seeing the person. That being said, I think a social internet where everything looks the same, where Instagram looks like TikTok and TikTok looks like X, and I don't love that. I predict that there's going to be one or two new social platforms that are going to look completely different than the video-based platforms that we see today. Right now, you want to be a pro at video and short-form video, and I think starting with either Instagram Reels or TikTok are great places to iterate.
As opposed to like a YouTube Shorts or something.
Yeah. Iterate with there, like download CapCut, iterate on TikTok and Instagram, and then try to get the format of your video really dialed. Have a concept for what's going to work and something that's repeatable. So think of the man on the street videos, like how much money do you make? Or it's like the watch guy comes up to someone and says, hey, is that a Rolex Daytona? These luxury watch negotiations. These are concepts. So you have to come up with a concept. Then you have to iterate on it. And then you have to post it a bunch of times and see what people like. And then once you have that, you start building an audience. And that being said, I'll caveat with, if you are more into tech, more into professional stuff, I think LinkedIn and X are great platforms.
You said that we're kind of having like a social crisis where everyone's just way too online and socializing less. And that seems to be a common view. What's the solution there?
It's tough. The solution is we have to have strong willpower is the actual answer.
These systems are designed by some of the smartest people in the world to attack our willpower. It becomes harder and harder for us to fight against it, each individual.
That's true. That being said, I like McDonald's and I would love to have like nuggets, McNuggets, but I probably have it once every 5 or 10 years because I have some restraint and I know it's not good for me. And I know there's a bunch of chemicals in it.
But if you really like McNuggets, why not have it at least every quarter or something? What's worth the delayed gratification of 5 or 10 years?
That's true. Maybe I do need to have McNuggets a little bit more often.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to encourage you to have a few more McNuggets.
Exactly. Maybe someone who's listening to this will send me like a gift card. But yeah, I think we live in a world full of temptation. We need to teach how to deal with that. If our phones essentially become casinos, which they've become, dopamine casinos, then I don't have faith that Apple or Google or whoever are going to put, hey, don't use this product, because their incentive, going back to show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome, is that they want people on apps. They want people buying apps. They want people spending money on the platforms. And the platforms also want people to spend more time on these places, watch more video. The solution is to acknowledge everything in moderation, including McNuggets, and try to show some moderation.
There's a thread out there that says these new GLP drugs like Ozempic and stuff will allow us to combat some of these other certain addictive type behaviors. Do you think there's like any truth to that?
I have a friend who's taking one of these drugs and he didn't have a problem with alcohol, but he definitely drank more than he should. And he was telling me that he has no desire anymore to drink.
Crazy.
It's crazy. This is a guy who is drinking, I don't know, 4 nights a week, 5 drinks, something like that.
5 drinks per night.
Per night. He was drinking like half a bottle of wine to a bottle of wine for 4 nights a week, basically. Maybe that is a problem, actually. I think it's probably a problem. So he had a problem with alcohol and he hasn't had a drink in like a year.
That's insane.
It wasn't even like he was like, I'm going to take this drug and I'm not going to drink anymore. It was just a side effect of the drug.
There'll definitely be these things to inhibit your addictiveness. So if you feel like you're a little bit too addicted, so if you're aware of your addiction, at least you're a little bit too addicted to your phone or a little bit too addicted to TikTok or a little bit too addicted to gambling or whatever, it's possible these inhibitors, that might not be a good thing for society. I don't know, maybe it'll become less creative or whatever it might be, but people could have less addictive personalities.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. I generally try to refrain from like taking prescription pills when I can and stuff like that. How can I do this organically? I'm just talking about my own life. This is how I live my own life.
Well, for people watching this video, you're incredibly fit. Maybe not everybody has the same regimen that you might have.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling me fit. I appreciate that. You are also incredibly fit.
Mine is AI. This is not actually me.
Here's a way to put it. There's a group of people who need prescription drugs to live their life. For those people and for those drugs, I'm grateful for. There's another group of people that probably don't need prescription drugs to change their behaviors. But it's easier to take a prescription drug. And those are the people that I'm talking about.
The overprescription of like Adderall and some of these other types of things.
Exactly.
Now, you wrote this super piece on unbundling Reddit. What do you think is the opportunity there long term?
This has been basically the core thesis of our studio, which is there's thousands of subreddits.
Niche communities, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Niche communities. I use a platform called redditlist.com, which basically shows all the different trending and growing communities. There's other tools I use as well, like AI tools to basically tell me what's going on in the world of Reddit. What are people talking about? And what are the niche communities that are not the top 100, but are trending in the right direction?
So you would have seen pickleball well before any of us saw pickleball.
7 years ago. I would have saw longevity 9 years ago. Just people interested in. So it's picking up on that, getting in early, understanding the insights, and then building audiences and communities around those things.
Some of them may just be a fad and go away, but some of them may really become the next pickleball.
Exactly. Like paddle.
Which is probably the next pickleball already. You have this other great Substack on like hot takes for the startup world last year. And one of them was people are saying ChatGPT wrappers are dead on arrival, but you think this is less true. You think actually it's like really good businesses can be built on that. How do you think about that?
I don't think people would say that owning a blog or owning a content website is not worth doing because it's wrapped by Google. Meaning for a long time, all internet websites were essentially a wrapper, quote unquote, on Google, based on Google. You derived 80% of your traffic from Google and Meta. We talked about building on the shoulder of giants earlier. I think if you're building on the shoulder of giants, there's always the risk that your giant is going to trip on a rock and fall down. And you have to acknowledge that as a key risk to building on the internet today. That being said, I think that there's this narrative that has been perpetuated that no, don't create a vertical SaaS or something like that on top of GPT-4, Shopify, whatever, because they're just going to pull the rug. And number one, there might be enough cash flow for 12, 18, 24, 36 months where it actually makes a lot of sense, just like financial sense to continue doing it. And also number two, you actually might be totally cool. No one knows what's going to happen.
Let's say you get a $20 million business, which would be amazing. For these platforms, they could care less about a $20 million business, especially if they pulled a rug and that $20 million business became a $10 million business. Like, what would they care?
There's a guy who owns PDF.ai. Have you seen this guy?
No.
His name is Damon Chen. What PDF.ai does is you can basically chat with your PDFs using AI. Let's say you upload like a legal document, you could ask for a summary or stuff like that.
So it's like a UI wrapper on ChatGPT, essentially.
Exactly.
That sounds so cool.
It sounds cool until ChatGPT allows you to chat with your PDF 3 months ago. So then I saw on Twitter all these people being like, oh my God, we told you so, it's over. The guy had like a little blip, a small I don't know, 5-7% go down, but now he's completely back up. That's because he's still the best way to chat with me. If you're thinking about building a wrapper, you got to go hyper specific. And my advice to Damon, I don't know him, would be like, how do you make this even more niche?
Get even more or more legal or whatever it might be.
Exactly.
Now, you have this great piece titled, Why I No Longer Hire from Harvard and Google. Unpack that a bit for us.
Well, first of all, that was before the whole Claudine Gay debacle. So I just want to be clear about that. I've been saying this for years. And the reason I've been saying this for years is I didn't go to Stanford or Harvard, but I grew up in Montreal, Canada. I ended up dropping out of school. I didn't know a lot of people who worked at McKinsey, or I didn't know anyone who worked at McKinsey or worked at Google, or I didn't know anyone. Like, I'm from this French speaking city where it's kind of like its own bubble in a lot of ways. And I actually realized that the people who have the most amount of grit are people who didn't necessarily graduate Harvard or graduate Stanford. Of course, there's tremendous talent out of those places. Incredible. But I just think that the idea is you don't need to hire from the big tech firms. You don't need to hire from the Ivy League because you're like, oh, this product's not going to work unless I hire a director of product who like graduated Stanford product design and worked at Snap as employee 1000. The 0-to-1 skill set is a very different skill set than the optimization skill set. And a lot of the people who graduate some of those schools end up working at the larger companies who are in optimization. And the people we like to hire, or the people we like to partner with even, are people who are 0-to-1 people just because of the nature of our business.
It's helpful also to find someone at some point who's been punched in the face. And see how they reacted. If you've been a stellar student all your life and went to Harvard and then Google, McKinsey, whatever it might be, you could be in a scenario where you're in your mid-30s and never really had any, at least career issues. Maybe you had a personal thing that happened to you here and there, but never a career issue in your entire life. And so as an employer, it's hard to know how that person will react when they have some misfortune.
Yeah, I think that's right.
When you're looking for these kind of 0-to-1 people, I mean, you mentioned earlier, okay, well, the best way is figuring out like they've started something before. They have like a form in a way, like, hey, here's a form, fill this out, tell me something you started or something. I'll go look at it and then I'll get back to you if I'm interested. You need some sort of gate. The reason why people use Harvard and Google and some of these things is that it's really easy to screen out resumes really fast and then only interview certain types of people. I imagine you have like tons of inbound. Like, how do you have that gate?
One is we reach out to people daily. We're scouring places like Product Hunt or Dribbble, which is a design community, and we see what people are posting. If we think it's cool, we'll be like, hey, we think that's really cool. And you might be like a solopreneur and might be interested in being a part of a platform like Late Checkout.
Almost not getting the inbound, but more just actively reaching out to people that build cool stuff.
Exactly. I don't think enough people actively reach out. The second thing is someone reached out to me actually yesterday, and I think we're actually going to hire him today, which is a crazy turnaround. He figured out my email, which I just like. You can see that he emailed, I'm not going to say what my email is, but he emailed 10 different emails in 10 different iterations. He landed on the right one. That itself shows grit. And then he sent me a 5-minute Loom, a recorded video of 30 seconds on him, and then 4.5 minutes around, here's the 5 things I would do if I were you. And 30 seconds about him, we're very focused on, I launched this product, I built this product, I scaled this product. And that's music to your ears when you're building a product.
This is my like general advice for anyone who's looking for a job is you need to show value to the company. People are always like, oh, I want some advice. It's like, no, just tell them how you can make their product better or something, or what you can do. You've done some research on it. If you can do that, you may or may not be a right fit for that company, but they're going to want to talk to you for sure.
Those types of people really stand out.
They stand out because they're so rare. We can have like 50 podcasts talking about this and we'll probably increase the number of people who do it by like 1%.
Totally. A partner at Late Checkout sent me a message saying after he watched the Loom, he goes, I'm totally amped about XYZ person's potential. And then I wrote potential gem. Totally, these people are out there. And this is what he said as a response, which I think is so true. He's like, these people are everywhere yet nowhere.
Totally. Now you were, we work from like 2019 to 2020, kind of as the ship was going down. What was that like?
It was like watching a movie. It was like being first row at the movie. I really felt like I was a part of it. And just watching it at the most stressful, tense moment. Because I joined May 13th, 2019. And WeWork was supposed to go public in September 2019. I was employee like 13,000. By September, we were 17,000. So they were hiring like absolutely crazy. It's just unheard of. And it just unrolled from September. The summer, people were rumbling. There's headlines like, should WeWork be at a $47 billion valuation? And then all of a sudden, it just went down from there. And so what was it like? It was fascinating to see. Unfortunately, a lot of people saw their wealth destroyed, employees and stuff like that. So that sucked. And it sucks seeing people becoming friends with people and them telling me, hey, like, I can't wait till we go public because I'm going to buy my dream house. And then it's like, I guess I'm going to rent for another year. And then it's like, oh, I just got laid off. How am I going to afford my rent? So that really sucked.
A couple of personal questions we ask all of our guests. What conspiracy theory do you believe?
Define conspiracy theory.
Something you believe in where you think a bunch of people are working in cahoots or doing something together and could be for good or for evil.
I think taxes are basically made up.
What do you mean?
I was living in Canada. I was getting taxed 51%, but in return, I got free healthcare and free education and stuff like that. Then I moved to South Florida. I'm getting taxed a lot less. There's no state income tax. And I just feel like what happens with taxes is they creep up over time. I would bet that where I lived in Quebec, they probably didn't start at 51% or 50%. They probably started at 40%, but then they need money for this and then this and this. And then once you're taking that money, it's hard to get out of it. My theory is that it's like a made up number that unfortunately affects everyone.
I'm not familiar with Canada, but in Europe, France, for instance, has a very high tax rate. California is like 54%, but I think France is much higher. But I think the way it works there is that the kind of rich pay the taxes, but the super rich don't pay any taxes because US is one of the very few countries that has a global nexus. And so once you're in France, you're like moving your money through Switzerland and Ireland and through the Caymans and et cetera. So once you get a wealth above a certain amount, let's say some dollar amount, your tax bill goes almost to zero. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the same thing in Canada, the super wealthy people. Whereas if you live in California, it's just much harder to avoid it. There are super billionaires like Sergey Brin that avoid it. But for most people, it's much more difficult.
It's funny you mentioned that because I was recently in the Cayman Islands for a few days. And I was walking around and I see all these Canadian banks, Royal Bank of Canada, Toronto Dominion, TD Bank, Scotia Bank, which is Bank of Nova Scotia. And I'm like thinking to myself, why? This doesn't make any sense. I'm in this Caribbean island, by the way, is amazing. And it's kind of weird that so far from Canada, there's all these banks. And then someone told me, well, yeah, it's because a bunch of Canadian like billionaires basically do a lot of work here.
It's easy to raise the taxes when the super rich don't pay it. The ones with the most influence don't pay it. They're happy for you to raise the taxes. All right, this is great. Last question we ask all of our guests. What convention of wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Right now, there's this advice that go build a startup. And it's just like romantic idea. Go build a startup. Go build a product. Go on your own. Leave your cushy job. Escape your 9-to-5. I actually think that's relatively bad advice for the vast majority of people. And in fact, there's a lot of people I've worked with who worked with me, but I was the founder who did extraordinarily well. This idea around in order for you to gain wealth and freedom, you need to go out on your own, I think is a narrative that is just spread.
It's also not for most people. Even if it is advice for some people, for the vast majority of people, it's probably bad advice.
And I'll give you a bonus one, which is the CEO is probably the worst job at the company, but the best job at the company is to be a co-founder.
Totally. That's the best job. Yeah, exactly.
That's the best job. So you have more equity than an advisor, but you have less responsibilities as the CEO.
I actually don't even know the names of the other two co-founders of Airbnb, but I bet you they're way happier than Brian Chesky.
Totally. That's something I wish someone told me too, and I'm happy you agree with me on that.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, Greg Eisenberg, for joining us on World of Desk. By the way, I follow you at Greg Eisenberg on Twitter. I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. This has been a ton of fun.
I appreciate it. No, this is really cool. And also check out my new YouTube channel at Greg Eisenberg. Or actually, you can find everything on my website, gregeisenberg.com, my Twitter.
Okay, gregeisenberg.com. I hope everyone goes there for sure. All right, it's great.
Take care.
If you're a super data nerd, go to worldofdas.com. That's DAAS, worldofdas.com, and sign up for our weekly data as a service roundup newsletter. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of DAS, and DAS is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Auren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Auren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of DAS is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of DAS. Check it out at flexcapital.com.